Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, their job is self-explanatory, protect the environment. So then why do we have honeybees disappearing, giant dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico, and more toxins than ever in our ecosystem? E.G. Valientos is the former employee of the EPA. He's turned whistleblower. He's the author of Poisoned Spring, The Secret History of Pollution and the EPA, along with five other books. And we're going to be talking about his book, and we're going to be inviting you into our conversation. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. What are your thoughts about the EPA? Are they doing a good job as a cop on the beat? Are you not satisfied, or you think they have gone way beyond their powers? Call in 210-614-8980. Email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. So, E.G., how are you doing? Welcome to The Source.
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much.
So you say the EPA really should be called the Politician Protection Agency. Tell me why.
The Polluters Protection Agency, yeah, you're right. Why? Because the agency, for the last several decades since its founding in December 1970, has gradually and inexorably moved towards protecting the polluters much more than it protects you and me, and that is protecting our water, air, the air we breathe. I mean, this is especially food. It has been captured. I mean, it's a classic example of the industry having so much power and using the White House and Congress, and eventually they capture the so-called regulated agency, the agency that's supposed to regulate it over them. So this is why I had to reach the conclusion that the EPA these days has been a polluters protection agency. That does not mean that I don't like the place. I love the place. I think it has been the greatest invention in this country, the greatest political invention of the 20th century, because we do need a centralized agency like the EPA to protect us from toxins in the air, in the water, and the food that we eat. I mean, it's fundamental to public health and the kind of a balance in the ecosystems. Without that balance, then we have epidemics of disease, as we do right now, and we have polluted food, polluted drinking water, and polluted air.
So you're talking about regulatory capture. This is a phrase that we've heard mostly associated with Wall Street and the SEC and organizations that are supposed to be keeping an eye on traders. And we say that's why we had the mortgage meltdowns, because of the regulatory capture. But you're saying the same thing is happening with the EPA. They are supposed to be telling these industries not to pollute, but the industries are using political campaigns and contributions and their influence with politicians in Washington, D.C., and they basically have turned the watchdog of the EPA into a lapdog. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. You put it beautifully. That's exactly what has happened. And it happened in the about 2-3 years after the creation of the agency, about 1973-74. EPA banned DDT in 1972, and that was a major decision, because DDT was like a kind of a golden bullet. All the farmers and people that are concerned about insects were delighted. I mean, they were very offended by the banning of this chemical, and the EPA had the guts, so to speak, to do it, and it was done under Richard Nixon, and the administrator, Rocker House, was also a Republican. But yet they had the wisdom to see the danger, so they did get rid of it. And at that moment, the industry said to themselves, well, we have to do something about it.
So DDT was a common chemical, a toxin that was being used to kill pesticides, and people, they would spray it. They would go down the streets of here in San Antonio, spraying it into the neighborhoods, and kids would run out and play in the fumes of the DDT, having no idea that this was something that was shaving years off their lives. And then it was also being attacking the animals and the environment. We saw it, the thinning of the eggshells in some of our our bird species.
Exactly. Yeah, and especially, I mean, we go to the point that even the golden eagle, the symbol of this country, began to be threatened, because as you described it wonderfully, I mean, that's exactly what this chemical was doing. It was pretty much not only wiping out insects, but it was also wiping out the birds themselves that rely on insects as food, and therefore they got rid of it. And at that moment, the chemical industry got together and they said, we cannot allow EPA to continue to do this. So they began to vilify EPA in exactly the same way they vilified Rachel Carson, who, this was a former government biologist who in 1962 had published that wonderful book, Silent Spring.
Right,
and
which is your book, Poison Spring. The title of your book, Poison Spring, invokes that other title, Silent Spring.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's symbolic, so to speak. I mean, I'm not competing with Rachel Carson. I'm saying pretty much a different story. I mean, the same story, but in this case, I document everything I say by using the government's own documents.
Right, during that argument about DDT, there was this public discussion, and we had the same industry officials coming out and saying, no, you were mistaken. There's nothing wrong with DDT. This is something that we rely on. Industry needs it. And by banning DDT, you are killing jobs in the United States.
Yeah, they continue to do that no matter what you're dealing with. Right now it's with glyphosate or Roundup or with any other chemical that you threaten, because it's shown that these chemicals eventually result in cancer, neurological disease, and other problems, in addition to wiping out species, accelerating the extinction of species, poisoning the land from which we get corn and soybeans and food. And so sometimes the government steps in and gets rid of it, and then of course they come back and say, we are going to create unemployment, and they create all this malicious kind of gossip against the government doing anything at all. I mean, for decades the government, starting probably with the Bush senior administration, and then even before them, the Reagan administration, they have been completely weakening the agency. I mean, they began to shut down its laboratories. During the administration of George W. Bush, they shut down even its library. Imagine that. The government spending millions of dollars to fund a number of scientific studies. You put them in that library, and then what did George W. Bush administration did? Wipe out the library. They shredded the studies, they deleted them from the internet, so that they actually wanted to blind the agency, so they had no history and no memory. So therefore, it would be completely ineffective. And that's what the agency, as we speak right now, that's what it is. It's completely ineffective.
All right.
So it's a tragedy. It's really a national tragedy, because this is a wonderful place to protect all of us, not just me and you, protect all of us from unseen, invisible danger that comes through food, comes through the air we breathe, and the water we drink.
All right, so we're going to take a break. We're talking about the book Poison Spring, The Secret History of Pollution and the EPA. We're speaking with a former employee, 25 years veteran of the EPA, E.G. Valientos. And so you're making some big claims here, E.G. And so I want to ask you about these things. You need to back them up when we come back from this break, okay? And the phone lines are going to open up at 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. What are your thoughts on the EPA? Too weak, too powerful? Let us know. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Is the EPA, the Pollution Protection Agency? That is the big claim by E.G. Valianatos, and he is a former employee of the EPA. He's written the book Poison Spring. He's written six other books talking about the environment. And so, E.G., what is going on with the honeybees?
The honeybees, the story started decades ago. I remember seen memoranda and emails, especially memoranda, dated from 1976. And in those memoranda, the ecologists of the EPA were, well, actually begging their superiors to stop, to put an end to this poisoning of the honeybees. They had discovered that the industry had managed to register or have it government approved neurotoxin pesticides encapsulated into micro capsules. These bubbles were full of neurotoxins, so the farmers were spraying them. They were, so they kept, you know, allowing the neurotoxin to get out of them for the, several days rather than a few hours. So the ecologists were taking pictures of dead bees. They were reporting, and instead of actually putting a moratorium to find out why all these deaths, they kept expanding the approval rate of these neurotoxins to the point that we are coming today. Now, the, all these old neurotoxins that were based on the pesticide parathion, now they're based on something coming out of Germany called neonicotinoids, which are based on nicotine, but they have the same neurological effect. They harm the brain of the honeybee. So the honeybee loses its ability to find where it's coming from, so it dies out, or it dies immediately, or it brings the poison into the hive and the whole hive dies down. And not only that, but we have to think about this. This poison ends in the honey that we eat. So not only we actually are destroying the honeybees, but we are slowly poisoning ourselves because honey is such a delicious, a wonderful food, and very nutritious food too. So this is, I think, fundamentally the reason why we have all this so-called colony collapse disorder is because of pesticides rather than any kind of other biological factor.
But we've been told that it's a mystery. We've been told that we don't know why there is a colony collapse disorder.
I think it's a misleading idea that we don't know. We definitely do because we have the evidence of all these deaths starting from the mid-70s down to today. And the EPA itself in its own files has the evidence. But regrettably, the authorities, or because they get their orders from the White House and Congress, they keep, you know, using all this propaganda that we are doing this study, we're doing that study, and we need another 2 years to revisit our data and so on and so on. But the straight fact is that the stuff that the pesticides, the farmers use are deadly to honeybees.
Okay, let's get a caller on the air. The number is 210-614-8980 if you want to call in. Jim is on the line. Jim, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call again. Yeah, the whole petrochemical industry is reflective of our individual and collective hubris on these issues. We generally default to the position of ignore it until it's proven to be a problem, rather than prove that it's safe, and then we put these chemicals into use. There are thousands of chemicals in common use that have never been evaluated for their safety. And it's a travesty that we would gut an agency like the EPA of their information and ability. And I would advocate, even though I don't like an onerous government, if there's one area that they do have a legitimate role, it is to protect us and the environment that we're dependent on.
Well, Jim, we need a high food production, and a lot of these chemicals are necessary in order to feed everyone and keep the food cost as low as we can to feed people.
Well, you know, there's some validity to what you say. However, there's a growing body of evidence that as we go to sustainable agricultural methods, and yes, the scale of production changes, but the methods change. And it also produces a larger number of people reemployed, if you will, back into the agricultural industries. The agribusiness model ultimately will fail under its own weight. So we need to make the transitions while we have the options to do so in a knowing way rather than panicked about it in the decades in front of us.
All right, Jim, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. Let's get another call in the air with Earl. Earl, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing?
Doing good, sir.
I just want to say that...
Okay, we just dropped Earl. I'm sorry about that, Earl. We had a technical breakdown. And is EG, are you there, sir?
Sorry.
EG, you there?
Yes, I'm here, yes.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry. I know we dropped the call for a second. We had a caller saying, complaining about the... agricultural chemical complex and about how these chemicals should be proven to be safe before they're allowed out on the market, and not put them on the market and then find problems down the road. But you have written also about the so-called Green Revolution, claims that the United States technology has provided the information necessary to that we can feed the world, and you challenge that.
Yes, I do, and it's still true to this very day that as we speak, we produce food for 14 billion people. So it's not a matter that we don't know how to grow food. We are producing, in fact, too much food. So these chemicals are really unnecessary for agriculture. And the proof of that is that we have the organic farmers who do not use synthetic chemicals. So the reason we use these chemicals is because the farmers have become very large, and they need herbicides, they need insecticides, they need to spray them in tremendous number of acres to produce the one crop that they actually produce. So that if we were serious about public health, we would change or reform our agricultural system, go back to some kind of a family farming model, and then we gradually phase out these chemicals, because we know how to grow food without these chemicals. Well, and the Green Revolution is not really necessary. I mean,
can we really feed the billions of people that we have on this planet with family farms?
Yes, sir, because per acre, the small family farmer is more productive than the larger guy. I mean, that's a fact. and I discussed this fact, by the way, in the last chapter of my book. EPA had funded a professor at the University of Michigan, Michigan State University, and she saw that onions produced in smaller farmers had less amount of poisons than the ones produced in larger farmers. And there is also other scientific studies that show that the productivity of the small farmer is really unbeatable. In fact, even if you go to a place like Colombia or India, where you have small-scale farmers that we call peasants, those guys produce a tremendous variety of food, crops that is, and they produce per acre more than their neighbors who have plantations, and they focus on cash crops, for instance.
So you're talking about...
I wrote a book in 1976. That was my first book, and I challenged all this idea of the Green Revolution.
Okay, and so about how big is a family farm? How many acres do you have to have to make that work?
Well, in this country, if we go according to what happened after the Civil War, and there was the land-grant universities and the granting by the government of land, the acre limitation was 160 acres, and that they considered to be a proper size for a family farm. So why don't we stick with that traditional number, 160 acres? Indeed, most of the legislation down to the early part of the 20th century, the government said, we are not going to provide any assistance to anybody who has an acreage larger than 160 acres. But then the corruption came in, and the various agencies allowed farmers to get even larger so they could get publicly funded water, as in California, for instance. And the whole system was corrupted to the point that in the early 80s, they extended the size to 2,000 acres.
Right. Let me get a caller on the air. EG, hang on a second. Let's get Sarah up on the radio. Sarah, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I wanted to argue two points here. I know that our increasing population is going to require more food, obviously, but we can't argue that these methods aren't going to be enough if we're, A, using a lot of our food supply as fuel, as we do with corn currently. There's also large stockpiles of food that actually go bad across the world because they're not used in time. But another point, if we're producing chemicals to produce more food that wipe out the bee population, we are literally talking about eliminating the ability for many foods to reproduce. And I believe it's something like 80%. And the only reason I know that number is because of the children's books that I read my son that talks about, you know, fruit and vegetables and how little there would be if all the bees were gone.
Right. So
because it's about teaching kids to not be afraid of bees.
Okay, Sarah, thank you so much for calling. We're running short on time. So, EG, we need those little pollinators, those bees, to make sure that we have plenty of food. But what about using the food as fuel? When you go gas up, 10% of that gasoline actually comes from corn. It's not as powerful as gasoline, but yet you're paying the same amount for it.
I have already written about that, and I'm against it. I don't think that we should use food in order to fuel our cars. After all, we have better technologies. I mean, we can get higher mileage, we can get electric cars, so we don't need to waste food for driving around the highways. Okay. So I'm suggesting that we need systemic change in our economic and technological system. And the business of pesticides and contamination and the work of EPA all come in all this. We just don't create, let's say, a perfect EPA while we leave every other factor of the system unchanged.
All right.
Like the size of the farms.
So, okay, E.G. Valiantos, he is the author of Poison Spring, The Secret History of Pollution and the EPA. He is a 25-year veteran employee of the EPA. He's now blowing the whistle, saying that it's more concerned with protecting polluters than actually policing polluters. E.G., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.